I endeavour every so often to branch out of European history along the historical roads less travelled, at least in the Anglophone world. When encountering the history of Vietnam, which has left such an indelible mark on the American consciousness, the American experience of the Vietnam War, from the military record to its legacy in pop culture, tends to overshadow everything else. I find myself in the unusual position of approaching Indo-Chinese history from the French perspective, one that ends with the Geneva Accords of 1954, resulting in two incidental independent Vietnams. The subsequent popular history of South Vietnam is a stereotype, a proxy for American influence and the perpetuation of anti-communist containment, both of which had the effect, intended or not, of legitimizing the cause of the Vietnamese communists. When one discovers that South Vietnam's first president, Ngo Dinh Diem, was a Catholic, a superficial glance will only compound the stereotype. If one believes Catholicism to be a European and thus a colonial contrivance in the history of Indochina, it so happens that Ngo Dinh Diem's Catholic presidency coincided with that of the Catholic John F. Kennedy in America. My aim here is to confound the stereotype and deconstruct the seeming oddity that is Vietnam's Catholic regime under the direction of the Ngo Dinh dynasty. Catholicism in Vietnam, far from representing a mere extension of foreign power, played a pivotal role in the nationalist movement in Vietnam, known as the Third Force, aligning with Confucian and Buddhist opposition to communism. Such an understanding is necessary in order to appreciate the agency of the Vietnamese and that of the Ngo Dinh dynasty, in particular, in that of the nation building of South Vietnam, against chauvinistic accusations of American puppeteering. It's no coincidence that this story ends in 1963 with the assassination of Diem at the behest of the CIA, and a year before Lyndon B. Johnson's major escalation of America's involvement. For today's readings, I'm particularly indebted to Edward Miller, a British historian of South Vietnam, whose two articles are linked in the description. Catholicism in Vietnam, along with the experience of French dominion, needs to be established in its proper context. The Japanese clash with Catholicism may be better known, but the effect of missionaries in Vietnam was far more pronounced and enduring. With many of my Catholic-specific uploads on this channel, there is unmistakably an element of the lost cause, but that can hardly be said of Vietnam. Although dwarfed by the Catholic population in the nearby Philippines, there are still 7 million Catholics in the officially atheistic Socialist Republic of Vietnam, adherents rivaling Vietnam's Buddhist population, in fact, which will be surprising considering the content of this video. Ngo Dinh Thu, one of the members of the Ngo Dinh Triumvirate, along with Diem and Nu, emerged as one of the traditionalist voices in the Second Vatican Council, later becoming a sedevacantist, ordaining his own priests and becoming associated with the Palmarian church cult in Spain, thanks to Thuc's ordinations of its sedevacantist founder. A tangent, but an interesting one. He just so happens to be featured in today's thumbnail. Catholic missionaries began arriving in Vietnam as a consequence of the Portuguese and Spanish explorations and acquisitions throughout Asia in the 16th century. By the 17th century, the Jesuits had become firmly entrenched. While the Jesuits evangelized in the traditional Vietnamese script, a group of missionaries under the Portuguese Francisco de Pina were responsible in creating the Latin alphabet, national language script, which was later enforced during the French colonial period. During the 18th century, the Catholics in Vietnam, under Bishop de Pinhieu and the French were major allies to one Nguyen An, the unifier of the modern territory of Vietnam, and the Nguyen dynasty, the last imperial dynasty of Vietnam. The new emperor afforded his Catholic allies the ability to evangelize freely and establish various Catholic dioceses. Soon there were hundreds of thousands of Catholics in Vietnam, coexisting with Confucians and Buddhists. A similar commingling of Catholicism and Confucianism occurred in China, with controversial effects for the Jesuits, a discussion perhaps for another time. The emperor's son and heir had visited France and secretly converted to Catholicism in the late 18th century, indeed establishing a line of Catholic princes that were disinherited by the Emperor An when Prince Can, the Emperor's crown prince's son, predeceased his father. The friction within the imperial family exacerbated religious tensions in Vietnam, as the Catholics desired a Catholic emperor. The conflict reached a head when, in 1833, many missionaries were martyred. The protection of Catholic missionaries and converts in Vietnam was assumed by the Emperor of the French, Napoleon III, the protection of Catholicism representing a consistent strand in his foreign and colonial policy. Napoleon III would cite violations against Catholics as his pretext to establish a French colonial presence in Cochin China, around the city of Saigon. From 1862 until 1887, the French progressively expanded their influence into northern Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, until French Indochina was established. As the French had facilitated the rise of the Nguyen dynasty and the creation of a unified Vietnam, the French were ultimately responsible for entrapping that dynasty under a new colonial regime. However, Catholics, which had helped usher in French rule, occupied an awkward position under the new regime. By the late 19th and early 20th century, the French government had become virulently anti-Catholic. Many Catholic missionaries were thus considered a hindrance to the government, far from an asset. This can help explain how Catholicism in Vietnam transformed from a perceived foreign force, an agent, a vehicle for foreign expansionism, into an organic vehicle for Vietnamese converts to support independence from France. Ngo Dinh Ca, the patriarch of the Ngo Dinh dynasty, was a prominent Catholic mandarin under the Nguyen emperors, whom he supported, albeit unsuccessfully, in their struggle to regain independence from the French. French Indochina would endure until 1947. In 1940, the colony had been occupied by the Japanese, though the French administration, the Vichy administration, continued until a Japanese coup d'état, which again was prompted by aspirations of Asian self-determination versus the Europeans. What's remarkable in the case of French Indochina is that it didn't happen sooner. The French would never truly regain control of Indochina, as the communists under Ho Chi Minh would fight a continuous war for independence. With the Geneva Accords, the French departed. The Vietnam War indeed can be said to have begun from the proclamation of Ho Chi Minh's Socialist Republic in 1945, only ending with the unification of Vietnam in 1975, though the Viet Minh during that period were arrayed against many successive combatants, one of whom was Ngo Dinh Diem, the first president of the State of Vietnam. And here I found it rather instructive to have a very brief overview of the historiography regarding this man, and this segment is taken, among other segments, from Edward Miller's Vision, Power and Agency, The Ascent of Ngo Dinh Diem, and the link to that article is in the description of this video. Who was Ngo Dinh Diem? In the decades since his 1963 assassination, historians and other writers have offered diverse interpretations of his life and career. That Diem was an important figure in the history of the Indochina Wars is not in dispute. After all, the conflict that became the American War in Vietnam began as a revolt against Diem's South Vietnamese regime. But there is no consensus about why and how he came to play such a key role. During Diem's tenure in power, many in Vietnam and elsewhere described him as an American puppet who could have been installed and supported by Washington to serve US objectives in the Cold War. Accounts written since the 1960s, by contrast, have emphasized his notorious willingness to accept American advice and the fact that his alliance with the US eventually fell apart. Many scholars have thus come to reject the notion that Diem was merely a creature of US foreign policy, and have instead portrayed him as a product of pre-modern traditions such as Catholicism or Confucianism. Among these scholars, however, there is no consensus about the meaning and consequences of his traditional qualities. In some recent histories, he appears as a sage-like national hero who is thwarted by fickle allies. In others, he is portrayed as an inflexible autocrat who was doomed by his adherence to outdated ideas about rulership. These seemingly disparate representations of Diem as US stooge, virtuous patriot, or reactionary despot are more alike than they first appear. By rendering Diem in flat and simplistic terms, they all fail to acknowledge the particular and contingent aspects of Diem's ideas and actions. Whether Diem is alleged to have been merely executing American designs or manifesting traditional cultural and social characteristics, the result is the same in each case. His capacity to control his own thoughts and deeds is denied. In short, the existing representations of Diem have refused him his due as a historical agent. The effect, as one historian recently pointed out, has been to reduce him to the historiographical equivalent of a cardboard cutout, similar to how I would view the popular understanding of South Vietnamese history to simply be that of a stereotype. And here he gives a brief overview of Diem's early life. For many Vietnamese nationalists, the onset of all-out war between France and the Viet Minh in December of 1946 presented a stark and difficult choice. The thought of rallying to the colonial regime was distasteful to anti-colonial activists who advocated independence for Vietnam. Yet many nationalists also recoiled at the thought of lending support to Ho Chi Minh and the communist-dominated Viet Minh. Some refused to cooperate with the Viet Minh on ideological grounds. Others were wary of the communists for reasons of experience. Faced with such unpalatable options, these nationalists often declined to choose either side and decided instead to wait for the emergence of a third force, that is, an independent party or coalition which would be both anti-colonialist and anti-communist. From the mid-1940s, there were many attempts to create a third force in Indochina, but all of them founded on the ideological and political fissures which divided Vietnam's myriad non-communist parties, sects, and factions. As a result, many activists resigned themselves to maintaining a stance of uneasy neutrality in the conflict. The French chided such would-be third forces as fence-sitters, entendistes, while the Viet Minh derided them for hiding under a blanket. A well-known Catholic leader and nationalist, Diem, was counted among the most prominent of the entendistes. This was a misleading characterization, however, insofar as it implied that he was reluctant to take political risks. Diem was born in 1901 into a highly accomplished Catholic family. His father was Ngo Dinh Ca, Grand Chamberlain of the Vietnamese Imperial Court. His eldest brother, Ngo Dinh Khoi, served as colonial provisional governor, and another, Ngo Dinh Thu, became one of the first Vietnamese Catholic bishops. Diem upheld family tradition by becoming an official in the imperial administration, a mandarin, and he rose to the post of provisional governor while still in his late 20s. His success was due not only to his talents as an administrator, but also to his patronage, the patronage of Nguyen Hua Bai, a Catholic who headed the Council of Ministers in Hue. Though Bai had long collaborated with the colonial regime, He had become frustrated in the 1920s with French encroachments on the court's prerogatives, and he enlisted Ziem and his older brothers in an effort to pressure the French for reforms which would have restored a measure of Vietnamese sovereignty. In 1933, the French tried to mollify Bai by elevating Ziem to the post of interior minister. However, the move backfired when Bai counseled Ziem to step down in protest against French intransigence on the reform issue. Ziem resigned, established his reputation as an uncompromising nationalist, even as it also confirmed his status as a militant and ambitious Catholic leader. Despite later assertions to the contrary, Ziem did not lapse into political obscurity after 1933, but remained active in court politics in Hue throughout the 1930s, even though he no longer held office and was under police surveillance. After 1940, he intensified his activism in order to exploit new political opportunities created by the Japanese occupation of Indochina. The occupation of 1940-45 was peculiar because Japan allowed the pro-Vichy colonial government of Indochina to remain in place in exchange for garrison privileges and access to provisions. Such a policy was contrasted sharply with Japanese practices elsewhere in Southeast Asia during the Second World War, and it did not sit well with those Japanese officials who considered themselves idealists on the issue of liberating their fellow Asians from European colonial rule. Such was the premise for the co-prosperity sphere. The discontent of these Japanese idealists provided an opening for Ziem. And by 1942, he had become embroiled in a variety of anti-French intrigues. In 1943, he dispatched an envoy to make contact with one Prince Colongde, a long-time anti-colonial activist and pretender to the Nguyen throne, who had lived in exile in Japan for more than two decades and had ties to idealist officers and diplomats in both Tokyo and Indochina. Around the same time, Ziem established a secret political party known as the Association for the Restoration of Great Vietnam. This party seems to have operated primarily in Ziem's native region of Central Vietnam, and its ranks were filled overwhelmingly, perhaps even exclusively, by Catholics. In summer of 1944, the French Sûreté learned the existence of Ziem's party and began to arrest its members. Ziem escaped the dragnet, thanks to the help of the Japanese consul in Hue, who smuggled him out of the city by disguising him as an officer of the Imperial Army. He was flown to Saigon, where he lived for several months under the protection of the Japanese military. The August Revolution, the Socialist Revolution in Indochina of 1945, and the stunning rise of Ho and the Viet Minh did not reduce Ziem's determination to pursue his political ambitions. Instead of withdrawing from the fray as the French and the Viet Minh fought over the future of Indochina, he pondered how he might exploit the current situation to build a new movement that could eventually eclipse both of these powerful rivals. He knew that constructing a viable third force would take time, and in the interim he could not afford to directly challenge either the French or the Viet Minh. He therefore adopted the stance of ostensible neutrality in the conflict, while at the same time taking care to establish and maintain contacts with both the warring parties. In this way, Ziem hoped both to buy time and to expand the ranks of his supporters at the expense of his rivals. Ziem's efforts to use his position as a fence-sitter for maximum political advantage are apparent in his relations with the Viet Minh during the late 1940s. Despite his later claims to the contrary, his dealings with Ho Chi Minh and other Viet Minh leaders were characterized much more by flirtation than by rejection. Shortly after the August Revolution, he was detained by Vietnamese fighters in central Vietnam. After being held for a time in a remote mountain location, he was brought to Hanoi in early 1946, the North Vietnamese capital, to meet with Ho Chi Minh, who offered him a position in the Viet Minh Unity government. In later years, Ziem insisted that he had spurned this offer out of hand. He also claimed that he had persuaded Ho to release him simply by fixing the Vietnamese chief with the gaze and asking rhetorically, "Am I a man who fears oppression or death?" Despite his grandstanding, Diem was pragmatic enough to realize that a door should be left open to any Viet Minh defectors to the Third Force, and so he maintained contact with the communists. As the French attempted to resurrect Indochina after the war, Diem, who had once been touted as the head of a Vietnamese-Japanese collaboration government, found himself ostracized by all factions. The Viet Minh for stated reasons, the French for his advocacy of Vietnamese nationalism, and even the imperial court of Bao Dai, as the latter went down the path of collaboration with the French within the French Union, and later the French-sponsored State of Vietnam, a position that was unconscionable for Diem. Anti-communist independents from France were adapting to republicanism, and by necessity. Nevertheless, Diem provided the Third Force with a political program in the hope of gaining mass support, founding the National Union Bloc and then the National Rally, whose leadership was dominated by the Catholic allies of Diem. In 1949, he proclaimed a social revolution, and the words coming directly from Diem. It should be known that the present struggle is not only a battle for the political independence of the fatherland, but also a social revolution to restore independence to the peasants and workers of Vietnam, in order that each and every person in Vietnam can have sufficient means to live in a manner befitting the dignity of a man who is truly free. I advocate social reforms that are sweeping and bold, with the condition that the dignity of man will always be respected, and will to be free and to flourish. Superficially, one can look at this and think that this is inspired by leftism, or one could look more closely and look to his Catholic upbringing and background and see this as inspired by distributism, the idea of the common right of dominion in Catholic social justice. As Diem was also inspired by the humanism present in Confucianism, the bedfellow to Vietnamese Catholicism, it would seem, as exemplified by his father's personal morality and his experience in the bureaucracy, and then recontextualized for Diem through the influence of one Phan Boi Siao. Here also is the kernel of his brother Nu's personalism, and a philosophy which is inspired by the French theologian Moniere, and this later added to Diem's fusion of ostensibly traditional, revolutionary, and democratic philosophies, however you can attempt to reconcile these supposedly opposite ideals. The call of social revolution, however, in the immediate term, was insufficient to counter Diem's far more powerful rivals, and when the Viet Minh sentenced Diem to death in absentia, Diem fled. In 1950, Diem went into exile, which some have characterized as a spiritual as well as a political retreat. Diem would choose monasteries and seminaries in both the United States, Europe, and Belgium as his preferred residences, while coming into contact with Catholic activists such as Tran Chan Thanh. He was received in the Holy See in the Vatican, and was even granted an audience with Pope Pius XII. Contrary to the contemporary view that he was succumbing to a form of religious mysticism, insularity, and even essentially becoming a monk, his exile provided a perfect opportunity to court Western, and ultimately, American opinion, a fraught task when one considers that the United States and France were officially allies at this time. Fortunately for Diem, and this again is referring back to Miller, there were Americans who were sympathetic to his anti-French stance and his Third Force convictions that he proved to be remarkably successful in seeking them out. The list of prominent Americans who met and professed their admiration for Diem in the early 1950s include a Roman Catholic cardinal, a justice of the US Supreme Court, at least half a dozen members of Congress, numerous journalists, several important academics, and even William J. Donovan, the founder and head of the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the precursor to the CIA. As a group, CM's American admirers defied easy categorization. Though many were Catholic, a significant number were not. Wesley Fischel was Jewish, for example. Similarly, CM's appeal was not confined either to conservatives or to liberals. In addition to attracting the attention of prominent conservatives like Donovan, he also impressed liberals such as Senator Mike Mansfield and the journalist Gouverneur Paulding. Indeed, the roster of American boosters which CM assembled during the early 1950s is notable for its inclusion of liberals and conservatives alike, as well as for its ecumenical and bipartisan qualities. But what accounts for CM's ability to garner the support of many, such a diverse collection of American notables? As virtually every account of CM's career has noted, part of his appeal to Americans lay in his staunch anti-communism. His stint in the US coincided with the high watermark of McCarthyism, a period when anti-communist credentials were the de rigueur for any foreign leader who hoped to win American support for a cause. However, if anti-communism was necessary to CM's campaign to attract American support during the early 1950s, it was hardly sufficient to ensure the success of that campaign. By itself, anti-communism hardly distinguishes him from the French and Bao Dai, the emperor, who retained their status as official US allies. Instead of anti-communism, some writers have fingered CM's identity as a Catholic as the key factor that helped him to attract American supporters. He certainly relied heavily on the Vatican connections of Thul, his older brother, the Archbishop, and other Vietnamese prelates during his exile. Among other things, he used these connections to arrange introductions to promising Americans and lodgings at American Catholic seminaries. Moreover, he was not averse to using his status as leader of the Vietnamese Catholics in order to win support from his American co-religionists. However, the claim that CM's Catholicism was the key element which explains his ability to garner American support is at best an exaggeration. Though he discussed religious matters in his private correspondence and conversations with his fellow Catholics, he does not seem to have envisioned US-Vietnamese collaboration as a prospective Christian alliance. On the contrary, in his conversations with non-Catholic Americans, and especially in public, remarks delivered during his exile, CM invariably eschewed religious statements and language in favour of secular arguments about shared commitments to the twin causes of anti-communism and anti-colonialism. In this sense, you can say that he is not a universalist and he is ultimately a nationalist. In summary, CM was able to convey his Catholic nationalism and his own struggle with the Viet Minh in terms uniquely suited to court elite American opinion. Christianity, Vietnamese independence conceived in terms of anti-colonialism, a policy which the US was pursuing ever more aggressively in the 1950s and 60s, and his opposition to Ho were recast in the context of the Cold War. The commingling of these ideals would reach their zenith when the Catholic John F. Kennedy became president in 1961, or so one would think. While CM was courting the foreign allies necessary for his conquest of power, his brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, remained in Vietnam to facilitate CM's return in 1954. By 1953-54, the French were on their knees in Vietnam and on the cusp of surrender. Under Nu's direction, the Ngo Dinh brothers had a new political organisation, the Personless Party, a mass political party. As the French were convened at Geneva to decide on the post-colonial settlement for Indochina, Diem was offered the premiership by the emperor. As a symbol, if nothing else, of Vietnam's real independence from France, and as a recognition of Diem's personal popularity and the efficacy of his political movement. The emperor's own views on Diem's appointment are recorded here in his memoirs. From my earlier experience with him, I knew that Siem had a difficult character. I was also aware of his fanaticism and his messianic tendencies. But in the present situation, there was no better choice. He was well known to the Americans, who appreciated his intransigence. In their eyes, he was the man best suited for the job, and Washington would not be sparing in his support of him. Because of Diem's past, and because of the presence of his brother at the head of his movement for national union, he would have the cooperation of the fiercest nationalists, those who had brought down Tam and then Bullock. Finally, because of his intransigence and his fanaticism, he could be counted on to resist communism. Yes, he was truly the right man for the situation. Nevertheless, arrayed against Siem were the French colonists, the army, Vietnamese sectarian forces opposed to Diem's Catholicism, and the Binh Nguyen, a criminal organization which controlled the police and the capital of Saigon. Added to that were a stream of refugees from the north, not to mention inheriting a war with the communists. The French still expected to have a controlling influence in South Vietnamese politics while abandoning the north to the communists, a position Diem would not accept as representing the will of the Vietnamese people, the culmination of Vietnam's independence from France. From the outset, Diem was at the mercy of great nations. The People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union had recognized Ho Chi Minh's government since 1950. France wanted Diem to fail, facilitating a French-friendly military government, while the United States waited to see which political faction would emerge triumphant. Confounding French and American expectations, Diem crushed the Binh Nguyen and assimilated the two major sectarian opposition forces into his own movement. He had consolidated the anti-communist opposition. To oust the last major obstacle to his legitimacy, Diem campaigned in a referendum against the emperor, and with his control over the political machinery in South Vietnam, he produced a near unanimous vote in favor of a strong presidential republic, with himself, of course, as president. Diem would not officiate over the elections agreed as per the Geneva Accords, the ostensible means of Vietnamese reunification. As they were agreed to by the French, Diem denounced the proposed elections as part of Vietnam's colonial legacy, made without her consent, while lambasting any hope that concurrent elections in the North would be free and fair. The quest of unification would have to be settled by war. As a Confucian, Diem conceived of the referendum as a manifestation of the mandate of heaven, revoked from the emperor and now bestowed upon himself. As a Catholic, Diem viewed Vietnam as a participatory democracy to ensure the fundamentals of Catholic social justice and common civic morality, expressed, of course, in its selection of a virtuous leader. Consequently, the third force had become the third way: personalism against American individualism or communist collectivism. Though given an electoral gloss, the government was under the control of a dynasty, the Ngo Dinh family triumvirate of Diem as president, Thu as archbishop, and Nhu as party chief, all with their own political philosophies, of which Diem acted as ultimate arbiter. Nhu's control over the party in particular gave him access to many private networks of supporters to entrench the regime at the grassroots level. In terms of consolidating a Catholic constituency in Vietnam for the new regime, united against the communists under Ho Chi Minh, I'm here reading for another article focusing on the Catholic refugees, which is by one Nguyen Phi Van, Fighting the First Indochina War Again: Catholic Refugees in South Vietnam. Until recently, critics associated Christian communities in Vietnam with Western interference in Vietnamese internal affairs. Recent research shows, however, that Vietnamese Catholics sought independence from both French missionaries and from colonial rule. During the First Indochina War, Many of them sided with the nationalist Viet Minh, and the dioceses of Phat Diem and Bu Chu secured autonomy from the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1945 in recognition of their alliance. This collaboration collapsed in 1951 as the armed conflict changed from a war of decolonization into a front of the Cold War after establishment of the People's Republic of China and its provision of diplomatic and logistical support to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. This turning point in the war had two substantial consequences for Catholic communities, especially after the Vietnamese bishops published a pastoral letter on the 10th of November 1951, urging all believers to side against communism. The militias of Phat Diem and Bu Chu, which had defended the diocese's autonomy up to that point, chose to fight against the communist attack and their infiltration. Other Catholics in northern central Vietnam, from Than Hoa to Quang Binh, and in the uplands parts of Vietnam, to the north into the central highlands, had spent almost all of the First Indochina War under the authority of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Just like their Catholic brothers and sisters in the Red River Delta, many of them broke with the Viet Minh during the second half of the conflict. These Catholics had gained first-hand experience of the transformative effects of the communists, the revamping of the civil service and land reform, which the Vietnamese Workers' Party implemented in specific laboratory zones to order to generate the manpower required for large-scale and modern military campaigns. The experience of the First Indochina War led many Catholics to migrate to the south once the 1954 Geneva ceasefire allowed civilians to regroup into zones of their choice, either the northern communist-governed zone or the southern non-communist zone. These refugees were not, however, representative of the Catholic population of Vietnam entirely. Many Catholics remained in the north, others went overseas, and southern Catholics had not developed the same political and religious practices. Nonetheless, the northern Catholic refugees became prominent in the Republic of Vietnam, as their migration doubled the number of Christians in the south of the 17th parallel, the new border. Their resettlement became a major objective of American modernization programs in the south. Their relocation was also important to their co-religionist, Ngo Dinh Diem, who became the president of the newly created Republic of Vietnam, or the State of Vietnam, as I'm going to be using consistently here, in 1955. He wanted them to play a role in his political, economic, and social project, which centered on agrarian reform. His interest in their playing this role explains the emphasis in many accounts of the history of the Republic of Vietnam on the overrepresentation of Catholics in its political and military affairs. Recent works have brought nuance to the accounts of the proportion of Catholics among migrants and the logistical role in the resettlement process. Yet none have explained the conflation of Catholic refugees with all Catholics, with all refugees, or with staunch supporters of Ngo Dinh Diem. It is thus important to demystify the relationship among these groups. Catholicism gained visibility both within and outside Vietnam during the migration, leading many authors to give the impression it only involved Catholics. Diplomatic correspondence and media coverage, the partition of the country, emphasized the experience of Catholics among the migrants to the outside world, as the main skirmishes between the forces of the Democratic Socialist Republic of Vietnam and refugees leaving the north happened in Catholic parishes. Ngo Dinh Diem and the French High Commissioner Paul Elay drew the attention of the international community to particular plight of these refugees. Coverage in Christian magazines also gave the impression that the migration was essentially Catholic. Within the southern part of Vietnam, the migration seemed to channel the massive support of the international Catholic solidarity. While the role of Catholic organizations such as CARE and the international rescue community was important, most of the private aid flowed from Christian charities. This aid circulated through Monsignor Pham Ngo Chi's Auxiliary Resettlement Committee, comprised of a team of 10 priests working out of Saigon. Even lay organisations such as the International Committee of the Red Cross and UNICEF sometimes had to distribute assistance from the precinct of churches, as they were the largest public spaces available in the camps in the south. the visibility of Christian organization in the efforts to aid the refugees gives the impression both inside and outside Vietnam that the migration was essentially Catholic, even though American governmental aid was by far the most important. The material assistance of international Catholic charities was not the only factor in explaining the large visibility of Catholics in the migration. The political influence of the Vietnamese church also seemed to magnify south of the 17th parallel, the border. Monsignor Ngo Tinh Tu, President Ngo Dinh Diem's older brother, epitomised the close relationship between the church and the state. In handwritten notes made in July of August 1954, he imagined that Catholic refugees could neutralise competing non-communist political forces there. High on his list of such forces were nationalist parties, such as that of the Dai Viet or the Viet Nam Quoc Dan Dang, as well as southern political and religious groups such as the Binh Siem, the Criminal Syndicate, and other sectarian groups which variously controlled Saigon and the large areas of the Mekong Delta. According to Ngo Dinh Siu's thinking, the new state could fully trust Catholic refugees. They should occupy crucial positions in the police and the army. South Vietnam would thus be entirely committed to the fight against communism, and its state would always remain loyal to Ngo Dinh Diem's rule. With the foundation of a strong government established, Diem directed his energies towards nation building. While the regime was, and is often accused of nepotism and corruption, the former which is patently true, in the context of the Vietnam that Diem inherited, he strove to end corruption. In addition to his victory over the Binh Siem, and in keeping with his social justice reforms, he closed brothels and opium dens, the latter especially being endemic in Vietnam. As a good Catholic politician, abortion and divorce were made illegal. But perhaps the greatest manifestation of the regime's political Catholicism was the state of Vietnam's consecration to the Virgin Mary. In a state where 80% of the population were Buddhist, the Catholics represented a political aristocracy, both in their bureaucratic, political, and military overrepresentation, and in their ownership of the land. The cornerstone of Diem's political program was land reform, as outlined in his original Declaration of Social Revolution. In summary, Diem's reforms can be summarized as a form of kulakization, resettlement and development. In the Soviet Union, the process of de-kulakization had targeted wealthy peasants, kulaks, and ultimately any peasant who could act independently of the state and the state's desire to collectivize, in other words, subordinate agriculture to political control. In what is clearly inspired by distributism, and what I believe equates to a complete opposite of this Soviet policy, Diem pursued a policy of middle peasantization to ensure a sufficient and generally even income and allotment for the farmers of the dissolution of larger estates, with the exception of Catholic Church property, which was exempted. Resettlement and development had numerous facets for Diem. With the issue of overpopulation and minority ethnic enclaves throughout Vietnam, resettlement provided an opportunity to evenly distribute population centres and change regional demographics, and by extension facilitate the national unification process or process of Vietnamization. Demobilised soldiers and refugees from the north could be allotted territory and form the basis of new towns. Combined to this was the policy of Agraville, locating farming districts within access of urban centres, which nominally should have provided peasants with both amenities and state protection. Such policies received significant American material support and were intended to integrate the peasantry into the state of Vietnam and counter communist subversion. Many officials on the ground, however, implementing these policies were typically incompetent or corrupt, or some of them working for the Viet Minh to induce peasants to defect to communism. Diem's policies only had limited success, and the attempts at demographic change in the name of unity caused inter-ethnic strife. All such failures caused friction between Ziem and his American backers, who were expecting success. Nevertheless, Ziem's desire to transform the peasantry into a counterinsurgency bulwark was working. In the cities, communist denunciations were rife, and tens of thousands of communists were jailed. The domestic communist threat by 1959 had been significantly reduced, and the North responded by ordering an insurgency operation against the South, the Viet Cong, combined with various attempts to assassinate Ziem. To counter the new communist threat directed from Hanoi, Ziem expanded his policy and recontextualized it, that of Aggrevilles originally, through the Hamlet programme. The intention here was to create over 10,000 self-sufficient villages, with their own food supplies, even education, combined to that of watchtowers and defences. Organised into defensible strategic hamlets, Ziem argued that this policy would provide for the infrastructure of Vietnamese democracy in their war against communism, villages being the prime targets for recruitment by the Viet Cong. And here, regarding the Buddhist crisis, I am again referring to Edward Miller, this article, The Religious Revival and Politics of Nation Building, Reinterpreting the Buddhist Crisis. Like other Vietnamese nationalists, Buddhist reformers faced new dilemmas in 1954, following the end of the First Indochina War. Between France and the communist-led Viet Minh movement, although most Buddhists welcomed the demise of French colonialism, many were worried about how Buddhism might fare under communist rule. These worries were especially acute for many Buddhists living north of the 17th parallel, in the Viet Minh-controlled recruitment zone, set up during peace negotiations in Geneva during the summer of 1954. In the year following the Geneva Conference, large numbers of Buddhists joined a massive exodus of refugees, moving from the northern to the southern zone, which fell under the authority of the newly established Ziem government. Although the majority of these refugees were Catholics, approximately one quarter of them, more than 200,000, were Buddhists. Like their Catholic counterparts, the Buddhist refugees who arrived in the south of Vietnam during 1954-5 usually retained a distinct identity and communal status. For example, northern monks and nuns established separate pagodas and clerical associations in Saigon. Many of the northern Buddhists were also more staunchly anti-communist than their co-religionists in the south. The migrations of the mid-1950s thus reconfigured the political geography of Vietnamese Buddhism in the way that paralleled that of Vietnamese Catholicism. During Ziem's first years in power, he was more accommodating to Buddhists and Buddhism than many would have expected. Relations between Buddhist and Catholic communities in Vietnam had long been marred by mutual suspicion and occasional eruptions of sectarian violence. Each group had bitter memories of atrocities committed by the other. But Ziem seemed determined to put these animosities aside and cultivate good relations with Buddhist groups. Many high-ranking government officials, such as the vice president and the foreign minister, were Buddhists. The top echelons of the army of the republic were occupied mainly by Buddhist generals. One northern monk who came to the south in 1954 later recalled that there was no feeling against Ziem among the Buddhists, and that many prominent Buddhist patriarchs had endorsed the new government. Ziem's dealings with Buddhists during the late 1950s were reminiscent of the old Nguyen attempts to co-opt Buddhist leaders and groups via patronage, forming vertical relationships. In April 1956, Ziem granted the association request to stage a second national congress. Significantly, this congress took place in Saigon rather than Hue, and its chief organizer was one Mai Tho Truyen, a prominent lay Buddhist leader who Ziem knew and trusted. After the congress ended, Ziem agreed to provide funds for the General Buddhist Association to build a large new headquarters in downtown Saigon, the Tsa Loi Pagoda, the Pagoda of Relics, and this was dedicated in 1958. The government also supported the renovation of existing pagodas, including the well-known Tu Dam Pagoda in Hue. Although Ziem would later view these decisions ruefully, Both Tsaloi and Tudan would become centres of anti-government protest during the 1963 crisis. His actions seemed at the time to be a good way to ensure Buddhist support for his government in its cause of anti-communism. Unfortunately for Tsiem, his patronage strategy was not always sufficient to ensure smooth relations with Buddhist groups and leaders, and his goodwill gestures were sometimes undermined by other actions and policies. For example, the government's blatant favouritism towards Catholics rankled with many Buddhists. Despite the presence of Buddhists in some high-profile posts, Catholics dominated many parts of the South Vietnamese government bureaucracy. Starting in the late 1950s, some Buddhist civil servants complained that their superiors were pressuring them into converting to Christianity. Buddhists also reported troubles in dealing with Catholic officials at the provincial and local level. Buddhist groups frequently encountered delays and resistance when seeking official permission for religious activities and events, and found themselves at a disadvantage in disputes with Catholic organizations. Such harassment raised doubts among Buddhists among the motives behind Diem's so-called personless revolution. Like almost everyone else in South Vietnam, Buddhists found the philosophical details of Diem's vision to be highly opaque. They noted, however, that Diem seemed to be drawing his ideas from certain Catholic thinkers, such as Monier. For example, Diem referred to Nan Vi, the term that Vietnamese Catholics used to render Monnier's concept of the person, la personne. Although Diem insisted that Nan Vi was not a specifically Catholic idea and tried to invest it with Confucian overtones, many Buddhists came to believe that the government was seeking to impose Catholic beliefs and values on non-Catholic Vietnamese, although one can argue that he was simply trying to Vietnamese ideas that were coming out of Europe. By the early 1960s, Buddhist complaints about discrimination and mistreatment were being voiced most loudly in central Vietnam. During the early years of Diem's rule, Buddhists in the central provinces had mostly refrained from criticizing the regime. This was thanks mainly to the policies of Diem's younger brother, Noh Dinh Khan, who had served as the de facto governor of the central region since 1954. Khan was autocratic and corrupt. However, he had generally followed Diem's pattern of cultivating local Buddhist leaders. It was only after 1960 that the patronage ties which Khan had formed with the Buddhist groups began to fray. Much of the trouble in central Vietnam had to do with Noh Dinh Thu, the elder brother of the new brothers. Thuc was a Catholic prelate who had served as bishop of the Mekong Delta diocese since the 1930s, and was widely considered to be the most powerful figure in the Vietnamese ecclesiastical hierarchy. In the late 1960s, the Vatican promoted Thu to the newly created position of Archbishop of Hue. Unlike the reclusive Khan, who preferred to wield power behind the scenes, Thu liked to flaunt his personal authority in ostentatious ways that often raised Buddhist hackles. Since Thu had been heavily involved in the regime's efforts to indoctrinate government officials into the intricacies of the personless revolution, some Buddhists worried that his move to Hue signalled the start of a new government-backed effort to impose Christianity on this specific region. The Buddhist fears were reinforced by Thu's decision to build a national centre for Marian worship at the site of a Catholic shrine in the town of Lang Vang, located close to the border with North Vietnam, consistent, of course, with Diem's consecration of the state of Vietnam to the Blessed Virgin. In 1961, the Lang Vang Cathedral became Vietnam's national basilica, a designation which underscored Thuc's declared intent to make the town into a stronghold of Vietnamese Catholicism. Buddhist feelings of anger towards Thu in the central Vietnam were compounded by reports that Catholic leaders were carrying out forced conversions in certain provinces. Catholic statistics showed that the number of communicants in and around the cities of Nan Trang and Cui Thong rose sharply after 1957. Buddhists claimed that many of these new converts had been coerced by Catholic prelates, acting in collusion with local government officials. Buddhist leaders also allege that settlers living at government-built settlements in remote highland areas have been compelled by Catholic administrators to become at least nominally Catholic in order to receive food and other supplies. And this, of course, would be consistent with a Catholic tinge to the resettlement policies and development policies. While the frequency of such episodes is difficult to determine, it is clear that the Buddhist leaders consider them a serious threat to the survival of their faith in the region. Vietnamese Buddhism posed a challenge that could not be ignored. In part, the Buddhists were worried that Tu and his Catholic allies were seeking to constrain their religious freedom. But these worries went hand in hand with the fear that Tu's aggressive Catholicism left no room for Buddhists to participate as Buddhists in the building of Vietnam's national future. Unlike Diem and Cam, both of whom had at least tolerated the Buddhist reform agenda, Tu appeared to have ruled out the possibility of a role of Buddhism in the regime's nation-building plans. Hu thus became the site of a confrontation that pitted the exponents of a particularly fervent brand of Buddhist nationalism against the most ardently Catholic member of the new family. Given the volatile mix of anger, ambitions, and personalities that existed in Hue in early 1963, it's not surprising that the spark which ignited the Buddhist protest movement was struck there. The Buddhist crisis emerged from a misunderstanding. Papal flags were commonly flown by supporters of the regime, and to commemorate the Silver Jubilee of Ngo Dinh Su's ascension as bishop, his supporters came out in force. In order to dress down his brother and, by extension, make a political point, Diem banned all such displays, ordering that only the state flag of Vietnam should be flown, lest French or communist sympathisers acted in kind, following from the papal sympathiser example. However, the timing was such that it coincided with a major Buddhist festival, and the order was invariably viewed as anti-Buddhist, sparking protests, which in then resulted in the suppression that resulted in civilian deaths. Though the government distanced itself from the protests, blaming it on communist subversives, the protesters, led by one Thi Tri Quang, escalated their demands, restitution for the victims and punishment for the perpetrators. The government's heavy-handed approach, which had served Diem very well in eliminating his domestic opposition thus far, was creating both domestic and international sympathy for the Buddhists, who were cast in the role of religious freedom fighters. Epitomising this were the self-immolations carried out by Buddhist monks in the summer of 63. Under pressure from Nu and his wife, Diem ordered a raid on the Buddhist pagodas, the ones he himself had been responsible for renovating and in some cases creating, under the pretext that they were harbouring communists. Indeed, this association with Buddhists and rebellion with communists is entirely consistent with Diem's entire focus on security, counter-subversion, building this anti-communist alliance, and the idea that if anyone were to defect from this, anyone were to counteract the nation-building which was established against communism, that this was necessarily an extension of communist subversion. So it's not completely disingenuous to believe that Diem did believe that there were communist motivations behind some of the perpetrators, albeit he was stretching that logic to its absolute extreme. In the end, as a result of these raids, over 1,000 monks were subsequently arrested. These were the images and reports that shaped American public opinion and helped dissolve the web of international patronage which Diem had painstakingly built up from the ground. Indeed, they became synonymous with Diem's posthumous reputation as a tyrant. As an ultimate demonstration of American disfavor, and a sign that Diem was losing his own mandate of heaven, the American ambassador to Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., made an official visit to the Tu Dam Buddhist pagoda after the raid. Given Diem's hostility towards the French, born of personal animosity, also remember, the French refused to protect him from communist assassins, and indeed it was born of political anti-colonialist necessity, he was ultimately driven into the arms of the United States. Contrary to the view that Diem was an American puppet, He viewed other diplomatic options, such as closer ties with India, while recognizing that military and economic aid from the US would result in a loss of sovereignty in the long term and demands for greater democratization. Prior to the creation of the Viet Cong, the Americans provided military advisors, but by 1963, roughly 20,000 American troops were stationed in South Vietnam. Given Diem's relative independence and wariness of the Americans, his fundamentally dynastic method of governance, and the PR disaster of the Buddhist crisis, Diem was becoming a diplomatic and political liability. Moreover, the Buddhist crisis had revealed a breach in Diem's anti-communist coalition, and in turn prompted mutinous sentiments within the army. Many, of course, the many high-ranking officers were Buddhist. Another point to consider is that Diem's removal was necessary in order for the United States to assume ultimate control over the handling of the war, given disagreements between Washington and Saigon over the effectiveness of such policies as the Aggreville, assuming ultimately that the Americans could do the job much better than a native Vietnamese leader. One General Tran Van Don became the leader of a military conspiracy against the government of Diem, and he made contact with the CIA and with Henry Cabot Lodge, both of whom affirmed that the Kennedy administration in the United States would not interfere if a coup were to occur. However, the Americans did interfere through the CIA liaison, Lieutenant Colonel Kernem, who provided funding and direction to one General Duong Van Minh, the operational chief of the plot, who ordered the assassination of both Diem and Nu after a failed escape. Recognizing the Americans' mistake, the North Vietnamese Politburo declared, "The consequences of the 1st of November coup d'etat will be contrary to the calculations of the US imperialists." Diem was one of the strongest individuals resisting the people and communism. Everything that could be done in an attempt to crush the revolution was carried out by Diem. Diem was one of the most competent lackeys of the US imperialists among the anti-communists in South Vietnam or exiled in other countries. No one has sufficient political assets and abilities to cause others to obey. Therefore, the lackey administration cannot be stabilized. The coup d'etat on the 1st of November 1961 will not be the last. These words would prove prophetic. The communists, overcoming all the manpower and resources Lyndon B. Johnson and Nixon would invest in Vietnam, the deployment of hundreds of thousands of US troops, resulting in the death of around 60,000. Diem, if he did end his career as the most competent lackey of the US imperialists, it was out of necessity and against his every anti-colonialist conviction. He earnestly believed, as with Nu, that the Buddhist crisis was a temporary and not an existential crisis, that he could provide security and unity to Vietnam, and that in the event of victory against the communists, the US would permit him to complete his social revolution on his terms, on Vietnam's terms. But if Diem's legacy can be summarized succinctly, beyond reducing his legacy to that either of Catholic fervor or corrupt despotism, Diem demonstrated himself as a viable alternative to Ho Chi Minh, as a leader, and indeed as a visionary for Vietnam. Instead, his ultimate legacy comes down to this. To quote from Henry Kissinger, "To be an enemy of the US is dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal."